Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Joel Dinnerstein, whose new book is The Origins of Cool in Postwar America, and Chris Champagne, author of Secret New Orleans. Joel Dinnerstein is a professor of English at Tulane University, and he has a very cool scholarly interest, the idea of cool itself. He's the curator of American Cool, a fabulous exhibit at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery. That was in 2014, and it was accompanied by a beautiful book of the same name. Today, we're talking about his new book, The Origins of Cool in Postwar America. Joel, I'm so happy to welcome you back to The Reading Life.
Susan, it's great to be here.
So you said this book took you 25 years to write. It's very long. 25 years, that's a lot.
It actually, my first semester, my first seminar in graduate school, my seminar paper was Notes Toward a Study of Cool, and that was in 1992.
Wow.
And I've been thinking about it and teaching about it and lecturing about it and doing research ever since.
Well, what was the first cool thing that set you on this path?
That's a complex question, actually a simple question with a complex answer. So the first thing is that when I was a kid and I grew up in Brooklyn before there were hipsters there, it was pretty gritty. And my junior high and high school were both 80 to 90% African American and Afro-Caribbean. And cool was a very serious thing, not in the sense of how to be cool, but it was like this floating important concept that was more important than anything else, than being rich, than being successful. Like, you knew it was important to be cool. And so I'd always taken that with me, and I always thought we shared those meanings. Like, I always figured everyone knew what this meant. And when I was in grad school my first semester, I asked a bunch of people what they thought it meant. And when I say it, I meant the question, what do we mean when we say someone is cool? What qualities do they have? And I got five different answers from the first five people I asked. So then I had a project. I went, how did this happen that what I think is a shared meaning has diffused into all these other meanings? Where does it start? You know, I'm somebody who's always interested in origins. And so that's when I had the project. It's right, all right. Let's see where this begins.
And so many great possibilities for human connection, because it is so personal and meaningful to so many people.
Yeah, and I had the word and the concept to start. And believe me, never in a million years did I think I'd find where it started or that it's actually traceable to one person in terms of its dissemination. But I found that out in the first couple of years, and I went, all right, well, here's where I start.
Here we go.
Here we go. Right? I have to start here.
Well, what comes across in this book is that cool is very much a guy thing.
Yeah.
And you talk about convergence of African-American and Anglo-American modes of masculine behavior. So talk a little bit for us about Miles Davis and Clint Eastwood.
Well, it starts with Miles Davis and Clint Eastwood, because most people, when you ask them as a representative of cool, will give you either James Dean or Miles Davis. Mm-hmm. And the Miles Davis answer goes back to the origins, which come out of jazz culture. So I start with him. And he's also at this amazing convergence in 1949 that I start the book with, in which he's playing at an existential cafe, as they're sometimes known, in Paris. And Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir and Juliette Greco are all watching him. And he winds up flirting with Juliette Greco and having a lifelong affair with her. And jazz is very important to the existentialists in France. And Charlie Parker had just released a recording called Cool Blues, which won the Grand Prix du Disque or something, which was kind of like best song of the year. Mm-hmm. And so this whole convergence happened, and I had Miles Davis. And also that Miles Davis has this very kind of fierce cool that he's known for, even though it wasn't there in 1949. He was still kind of a young romantic artist. So that's that part. And then Clint Eastwood is a huge jazz fan, and he actually starts loving jazz around the same time Jack Kerouac does, just on different coasts. And so he understands that improvisation and a kind of look of cool, kind of flat affect and a blank look, is important to self-presentation, probably self-preservation too, if you want to be cool in a hostile environment, which was true for African Americans in Jim Crow America, and would be useful for him when he plays a solitary outlaw who's almost always in danger, right? So I start with them as opposing views, as a disarming comparison, because people rarely would bring Miles Davis and Clint Eastwood into the same sort of sense of pop cultural history. And of course, Clint Eastwood makes the biopic of Bird, of Charlie Parker, who Miles Davis first works with. So there are a lot of convergences that I want to draw together, especially at a time when people tend to separate them and talk a lot about cultural appropriation and separate kind of white and black, at a time when this separation just was not the same, not in the arts.
Well, you do such a wonderful job with that opening scene when you have Julia Greco come up and, you know, sing along with Miles Davis, even though they don't speak the same language.
They don't have 10 words that they have in common.
It was such an evocative moment. It was really a lot of fun to read. Now, you're drawing together three important strands in this book. You know, they all deserve books in their own right. You write about jazz, you write about noir fiction and film, and you write about existentialism. That is a lot to pack into this story, but each one is essential.
And ultimately, it's just the first half. I mean, not that I'm trying to brag about it, but that's the first half that takes place till sort of 1952. Mm-hmm. And then we get the figures we often associate. We get Marlon Brando and James Dean and Elvis and Sonny Rollins and into sort of Paul Newman and Sidney Poitier. So there's a second half that draws on the fact that this all comes out of jazz and film noir and existentialism. Yeah, if I were smarter, I would have had shorter books. One called Noir Cool that was about film and literature. One called about Existential Cool that was kind of about film and existential fiction and narratives from Camus and Sartre and some American writers like Chester Himes or yes. John Barth. And then I would add a jazz cool book, but I'm not that smart. For me, I tend to be comprehensive and think, how do these things come together? And anyone who knows a lot about that period knows that jazz and noir and existentialism were related. And I just kind of took that as a challenge. It's like, okay, well, how is it related?
A lot. It's related.
So that took 25 years.
Right. Well, one of the things I want to talk about is that you do write about so many writers in this book. Mm. I mean, of course, Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett, those are the no-brainers in a way.
Yeah, no, they invent a kind of noir sensibility.
So did you like them always? Or did you have to go back and revisit them?
No, I don't remember when I first read Chandler and Hammett, but I always did like them. But I think I saw film noir first, and I was kind of a Bogart fan early. And that led me to the original books. Mm-hmm. And I then loved the books. But I actually can't recall the first time I read either one. But I'm always gratified that my students still enjoy when we read Raymond Chandler novels.
Oh, that's great.
So that's good.
And what about Camus? Camus and Simone de Beauvoir are so important in this book.
So actually, I was a Camus fan long before I was a Raymond Chandler fan.
Uh-huh.
Like I was just one of those, you know, undergraduate kids in the late 70s who read lots of Camus because it seemed to speak to me. It was about how do you not judge people in the world and find some sort of set of ethics that don't come from religion or from the laws of your country if you don't respect them. It was enough, close enough to Vietnam to pick that up. And I just thought he was a really ethical writer and person. And I really enjoyed his literary style. I mean, I read everything by Camus when I was in college. Luckily, it was a period in which used bookstores would always have like all the Camus paperbacks for a dollar.
I even remember what they looked like.
Yeah, exactly. I still own them all. Even though I've bought new copies, mm-hmm. I can't give them away because they sort of represent a period of my life. So the discovery of the book, and of course, there were many wonderful research discoveries. So the first time I read that, people often said that Camus looked like Bogart. and he took it as a compliment was just one of those times when you go, okay, I'm on the right track with this book.
Serendipity.
Because I didn't know that at all. And the same thing a bit with Simone de Beauvoir. One day when I was teaching my course probably about 5 years ago, I put on the syllabus one day that said Beauvoir and Billie Holiday. And the moment I put that down, I said, I bet there's a connection. Like, I was going to teach them separately in the same period. And lo and behold, I read Simone de Beauvoir's travelogue of 1947. And she goes to a jazz club she calls Billie Holiday's place. And she's there but doesn't sing that night. And it's such an interesting mistake because there was no such club. But she already knew so much about Billie Holiday that she assumed this must be her club. But even so, like, those are the kind of things that make, like, long research slogs valuable, is those kinds of discoveries and connections.
And there are a lot of gems in that book, America Day by Day.
That's a great book.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah. She actually writes incredibly well about race and jazz, as well as anybody does in 1947. I mean, it's really sort of eye-opening. And so what's really important for my book, for example, is that she goes to see Song of the South, the Disney movie with Zippity Doodah, and is actually hurt by the way that white audiences laugh at the black character. And so much more so than Sartre, who also wrote about racial oppression, or Camus, she actually really got it from her friendship with Richard Wright in Paris. She really understood what racial oppression was like and being the other, which is why she then writes The Second Sex and says, I'm going to do what Richard Wright did for women. So
thank you, Simone.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you also write a lot about Richard Wright and about James Baldwin.
Yeah. Baldwin's kind of one of the guiding lights of the book. He doesn't have a section, but he's so perceptive about the nature of white and other and the changing world in that era, from Western to the rebellions of colonies and anti-colonialism, and the problem of race in the United States and how people see African Americans. And he was a jazz fan and a blues fan.
Yes.
So rather than give him a section, he winds up being a guiding voice at many different parts of the book. And I found out that he was best friends with Lorraine Hansberry, who has a whole chapter and was not at all in the original plan for this book. But she was one of my great discoveries in this book.
So why?
So because in this period, I'm reading everything to see how they connect, I went back to read A Raisin in the Sun, because it's right in this period between 1943 and 1965. And the play is about all my themes, but they didn't make it to the movie, which is what most people see.
Right.
So the movie winds up being sort of about, it's about oppression and it's new. Sidney Poitier gets to play probably the first angry African-American man in Hollywood film. But the play is about jazz and feminism and black consciousness coming out of Africa and the generation gap and a sort of youthful frustration with limitation. It should always be mentioned with things like Howl and James Dean and Marlon Brando. It's part of the same generational rebellion. And I hadn't seen anyone do that. But that was only the first part. Then I went to the Lorraine Hansberry papers at the Schomburg Library in New York. And she is an amazing person with the kind of sparkling humanism and confidence I rarely see even in the American artists that I love and the American literary figures that I love. I mean, it's like Whitman-esque. It's that kind of power that she was both sort of African-American nationalist in her way and truly believed in a pluralist American vision. And I just got fascinated and I read everything. And of course, she has the unlikely dual influence of Simone de Beauvoir and W.E.B. Du Bois. They are her intellectual heroes. And that is a rare thing that those are heroes. Mm-hmm. And she also loved jazz and loved blues and wrote well about them.
This chapter in this book made me love her. I mean, if I were having my ideal dinner party, I would have her.
Oh, absolutely. And she also, you know, she was involved in the civil rights movement. She coined the phrase young, gifted, and black, which was a big Aretha Franklin record. She was good friends with Nina Simone. She was everywhere. She also wrote the first TV drama about slavery called The Dancing Gourd. And it got shelved because of pressure from Southern advertisers. And that's 1960.
And I love the way she always held everybody's feet to the fire. For activism. It was just, what a responsibility.
Yeah, I will say it's very gratifying that... I had said it's kind of stunning to me that she has no major biography. And someone who's doing a major biography wrote to me.
Oh, good.
And read the chapter and said, this is great. I'm going to give you, yes, bouquets of footnotes. So I said, I like those kind of flowers. That's
exactly.
Nice.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, we've been talking with Joel Dinnerstein, whose new book is The Origins of Cool in Postwar America. Joel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on, Susan. Pleasure.
Chris Champagne is a writer, a performer, a comedian, a poet, an all-around great New Orleans character. He's the author of The Roach Opera, that New Orleans classic The Yat Dictionary, and now he's back with a charming little book, Secret New Orleans. Chris Champagne, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Well, it's good to be back. Thank you.
Baby, why do you want to go giving away all our secrets?
Well, because theoretically they're going to pay me to do so. No. it was a fun project. Is what it was. I mean, I was lucky that I got it, and it's kind of up my alley in a way, because I always kind of like kind of quirky things, and it was interesting to try to find stuff. I have a degree in history from UNO, so I never get to use that too much in my daily life. So this helped a little bit with that, too, because some of the things that ended up getting in the book were because of they had a backstory that
of
people
course.
Might not know about.
Great backstories. Now, this is a charming little book that takes readers off the beaten path and places all over the city. Wonderful photographs of everything, too, which is so much fun. So I wonder, what was your personal favorite secret place that you gave up for this book?
Well, my favorite thing in it is at Antoine's, actually. It was Groucho's Beret, since I'm a comedian. And they gave me a beautiful tour. Miss Blunt gave me a wonderful tour. She had lunch. She was very gracious. She showed me all around. As we were walking down one of the corridors, they have all these dishes and plates, which is like dishes, as it turns out, and glasses and cups and different things that are in a cupboard kind of all through there, because it is kind of like a museum. And there was, in the middle of all this clutter, was Groucho's Beret.
Oh, I did see. That was a surprise to me. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, I thought that was something that would be a surprise to most people. He left the beret there. They sent it to him. He sent it back with a letter saying thank you. It was his favorite restaurant in the East. His favorite restaurant in the West evidently was Chasen's, but Antoine's was his favorite restaurant in the East, according to his letter. And there was no better place for his beret than a French restaurant in New Orleans.
Of course, of course. So I'm curious, were any of these places surprises to you? Did you have to seek them out, or did you really draw from what you knew about the city already?
Well, actually, I know everything plus two already. Well, you know, the first thing was when I was asked if I might be interested, they wanted a list. So I thought, and I've lived here all my life, so I came up with a few things I thought might be eligible for it. And then, of course, I asked friends. Then I did a research, books, internet. I went to Barnes & Noble a few times and kind of looked and see what they had on the shelf. And I did find a couple of things in there, that there was a book about businesses in New Orleans, because this is a history-driven book in some sense, because a lot of these things, of course, have a backstory. In that one, I found a couple of things. One was the Andrew Higgins home that he built for himself out of this substance that he had, building material that he tried to push after World War II, which is still there.
Thermocon?
Yes, Thermocon.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, there was something that actually tied in later. I did, the House of Brohl has a dollhouse museum that Bonnie has done. It's great. And when I went into her office, she was gracious enough to give me a tour. There was a framed sign on the wall about a canned frog business that her father used to run on Jefferson Highway, which I had no idea, but it was in that book that I had read before, so I already knew kind of about it, but I was kind of surprised to find it, because I didn't tie it in to her. So that was kind of interesting to me, anyway.
Canned frogs. Fascinating.
Canned frogs.
To everybody.
Ready to eat. Ready to eat.
Jeez. So I was really kind of excited by some of the literary things that you point out, like William Burroughs' house, which I knew about, but still.
Sure.
But that's special.
Yeah, well, there were a few things in there that I think that have been played out in the press here that people do know about, but, you know, they forget. You know, people go on with their lives and don't forget. And that's, if it's tied to celebrity, that was kind of one of the, you know, the bells that would ring to try to get it in.
And also, the Hank was here etching. I thought that was amazing. Tell people about
right.
that.
Right. Well, there's a concrete, like a sidewalk, with etchings in it that people put. And there's one in front of the R bar that's is a heart. And it says, Hank was here in 1955. And the legend is that it was Bukowski because his name was Henry. And his friends called him Hank. And, of course, for a long time, there was a suite upstairs you could rent called the Bukowski Suite at R bar. Now, I don't know. These are one of those things that you don't know whether it's him or whether it is him or not. But it's kind of like the story kind of drives that one.
It's a great story.
Yeah, plus there are other things about Bukowski that are linked here. You know, his first book of poetry and things like that. So that was also added to whether it was eligible to get in there, whether it was actually true or not.
And his relationship with Gypsy Lou and John Webb
right.
and The Outsider. And
that's
yeah,
correct.
So I like that. I'm going to go look for that etching. I have to
Yeah, I mean, I've been there a million times and I've never even actually seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I hang out there a lot at the R Bar.
And some of these things aren't necessarily places, but they're events. You talk about the Everett Maddox reading series.
Right. That's one that I do attend, but it's not that well attended when you consider how long it's been there and what an iconic thing it is. And it's kind of in the back of the bar, and I don't think it's in everybody's consciousness like it should be, I think. Neutral Grounds like that as well. And the St. John's Eve.
The head washing.
Yeah,
I thought that
that's
was
pretty
great,
interesting,
too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a once-a-year thing.
I know, once a year. But you can go to the Everett Maddox Reading Series at the Maple Leaf every Sunday at 3 o'clock, we should say.
That's right, every Sunday. That's right. And Julie was very nice, gave me a nice quote, Julie Kane, for that. So that was nice, sweet of her.
So tell us about the one thing that, many things intrigued me, but Graham Parsons' grave. That was such a great story.
Well, you know, the publisher, he didn't give me much feedback as far as when I would write the articles. And that was one of the two that moved him to actually make a special statement to me about the Graham Parsons thing. That's probably the most interesting story in the book. I mean, as far as, you know, like backstory and intrigue or whatever you want to call it.
So tell us, it's only part of Graham Parsons there, though.
Yes, I think it's 60%. I don't know how they figured that out. Maybe there's some kind of a way that they weigh you to something to figure out how much is left of you. I don't know, because he was burned up, unfortunately. I know it's a beautiful story to tell your children. And the thing about it is, you know, New Orleans is such a music-driven city, or at least in everybody's minds, and this is a guy that really has almost no link to New Orleans, like musically, even though he's a famous musician, and he's buried in Metairie.
Exactly.
So that's you have to buy the book to find out if you don't know already.
It's a great story, worth the price of the book, I will say. And also, you have some nods to the fairgrounds, your old stomping grounds, in this book, too.
Yes, there's the Fairgrounds Hall of Fame timeline, which is on the second floor. And of course, if you don't go to the track, you probably wouldn't know it was there. I mean, some people probably stumble across it during Jazz Fest. The other Hall of Fame I think of interest that you didn't ask about is the Sugar Bowl Sports Hall of Fame, which is in the dome. So you can only go see it if there's something going on in the dome. And even then, it's kind of off behind one of the escalators where you might not even know it's there. I mean, 70,000 people probably go through there and maybe like four people go to.
So which that's is a real secret.
So that is kind of a secret, even though you can see it if you look that way. It's interesting and that it's so, I don't know what the concept is behind having something like that where nobody can go see it. I mean, they were very nice as well. I mean, I had to get special permission to go in, you know, during the off season
and take a real look.
And they were very gracious. In fact, most people, when I contacted them, they were really helpful and very nice. There were only two exceptions, which I won't go into at the moment.
Darn. Maybe later.
Yeah, later. Yeah.
So what is your favorite of all these things, either as a discovery or a familiar spot?
The Creole Castle is pretty interesting.
That I had never heard of that.
No, it's just a residential thing in the middle of a block, and you can't really see the whole thing because it's been somebody's backyard, and you have to kind of like just get a peek at the turret. If you go by the turret at night, though, you can see a light up in the turret. Now, I don't know if there's spirits up there or a person living there or what, because I tried to contact them, but I didn't get any reply. But I figured they probably might not want people to come knocking around. And then I found out that I have a friend who lives, he's not that good a friend, but I do know him. He's not that good of a friend. He's just a guy that I know, and he happens to live in front of it. And I didn't know that at the time, so maybe I could have got a better picture. But I have a picture that only is available to the general public anyway, which is kind of the idea. You can't really have things that nobody can go see.
I'm just glad you haven't been arrested, honey. Really?
Well, a lot of people are surprised about that. It has nothing to do with the book, but...
Well, I mean, you love New Orleans. It's fun to show these things off.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Know?
No, it was great fun. I mean, she talked about the photos. My friend Paul Lanoux from high school is a photo buff, and he took the lion's share of the photos. And Johnny Traviesa, who's a well-known photographer in town took up the end of the book because Paul had two detached retinas, my photographer.
Wow.
So that was the end of that for him. He's doing good now, though. So, and I want to thank both of those guys and other friends of mine who contributed a few photos as well.
Well, it's the perfect little thing to pop in your pocket for a staycation or give to a friend and say, get out there, take a look, you know?
Yeah, it is. It could be a fun thing. And the book itself, the physical book, is really kind of a pretty book, actually.
It is. It's just so charming. You hold it in your hands and you're like, oh, yeah. So.
Well, thank you.
Well done, sir. Well done.
Well, thank you.
We've been talking with Chris Champagne about his wonderful new book, Secret New Orleans. Chances are you'll find something new no matter how long you've lived here. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Judy Walker signs Cooking Up a Storm Tuesday, December 12th from 5 to 7 at Kitchen Witch. That's for Taco Tuesday. The Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities presents the Winter Louisiana Cultural Vistas Party with special guest, National Endowment for the Humanities Interim Chair, John Parrish Petey. That's Tuesday, December 12th from 6 to 9 at the New Orleans Jazz Museum at the Old U.S. Mint. Adam Gussow discusses and signs Beyond the Crossroads, the Devil in the Blues tradition, Tuesday, December 12th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Big Class presents Kiese Lehman joining Carver High School students to discuss their book Between These Folds, Personal Narratives by the 11th Grade at George Washington Carver High School. That's Tuesday, December 12th at 6:30 in the Carver High School cafeteria. Umberto Fontova signs Crazy on the Bayou, Five Seasons of Louisiana Hunting, Fishing, and Feasting, Wednesday, December 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. Terry Lafargue signs The Very First Christmas Stocking and The Gifts of the Seven Coins, the never-before-told nativity story, Thursday, December 14th at 2 at Barnes & Noble Mandeville. Harvey Gregory Forney signs Number 1 Overall in the Third Person, Thursday, December 14th at 2 at Barnes & Noble West Bank. Jack Sullivan signs New Orleans Remix, Thursday, December 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Chris Champagne, discusses and signs Secret New Orleans, Thursday, December 14th at 7 at the F&M Patio Bar. Cassie Bryan discusses and signs Bayou St. John, A Brief History, Saturday, December 16th from 9:30 a.m. to noon at the Fairgrounds Coffee House on Ponce de Leon. Stephen J. Spire signs Three Little Shrimp, Saturday, December 16th at 10:30 a.m. at the Conundrum Bookshop in St. Francisville. Tubby and Coo's Mid-City Bookshop will be featuring in-store pop-ups by local artists, Saturday, December 16th from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, December 17th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. The East Bank Regional Library previews the Harry Potter Yule Festival, Sunday, December 17th from 1 to 6 at the East Bank Regional Library. Activities include being sorted into Hogwarts houses, competing for the House Cup, Harry Potter-themed crafts and activities, face painting, trivia, games, and a scavenger hunt. There will be sweet treats from the Three Broomsticks and Honeydukes, and magical creatures from the Audubon Zoomobile. Costumes encouraged. Free to all witches, wizards, and muggles. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.